My name is Anselm Franke. I'm head of the Department of Visual Arts and Film, and it falls upon me to introduce our next speaker, and I do so with great pleasure and excitement. Do we have to switch presentations, or is this taken care of? So Rosalind Morris is professor of anthropology at Columbia University in New York, where she has served as director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender and associate director of the Institute for Comparative Literature and Society. Morris has held fellowships at the American Academy, Berlin, the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton, Stellenbosch Institute for Advanced Study in South Africa, among others. She is the editor of Can the Subaltern Speak? Reflections on the History of an Idea from 2010, and also of the co-author of the major book, The Returns of Fetishism, with Daniel Leonard. Her publication Accounts and Drawings from Underground with William Kentridge will be republished in an enlarged edition next February. And next year she'll also release a documentary film about informal miners in South Africa. Her presentation is entitled No Looking Back, Julia's Lips, Laughter, and the Limits of Mimesis. Please welcome Rosalind Morris.
Well, I want to thank Anselm Franke and Anna Bruce for including me in the conversations at in association with the many shows that are going on at the moment. It's an enormous honor for me. I'm thrilled to be here. Last evening's events were a really changeful experience, and I know there are many people in this room who know much more about Julia's Lips than do I, but I will try to say something that perhaps can supplement the conversation that's already taking place. I know that everyone feels a little wounded by the previous presentation, and you probably want a moment to mourn. I'm nonetheless going to ask you to shift gears just a little bit. Julius Lipp published his book, The Savage Hits Back, in 1937, having completed the text in self-imposed exile in the United States. The photographs of the objects had been sent to Lipps when he was conducting field research among the Naskapi Indians in Labrador, Canada. These photographs comprise the collection around which the book is organized, though the detailed descriptions of each image often refer to aspects that are not visible in them, either because of cropping or because Lipps himself knew details of the provenance, context, or of the assemblage in which their objects initially appeared that could not be deduced from mere surface appearances. In the book, then, Lipps's memory fills in the collection, animating what photography, the camera and its mode of inscription, has somehow reduced. Sometimes Lipps is direct about the injury that the camera has perpetrated, lamenting that he cannot offer to his reader a fuller presence, and in these moments, his prose becomes more and more dilatory. It is in this context that he refers to the apotropaic figure number 56, lamenting that, unfortunately, only the head appears of what he terms one of the bogey masterpieces. Lipps, nonetheless, shares with his readers his confident discernment of figure 56's identity. It is immediately recognizable as an Englishman, he says. The aquiline nose, the long face, the enormous teeth, giving the man's identity away. On its website, the Hakave has provided us with the image that Lipps surely longed for, the absent image for what his flat, decapitated photograph had to substitute. In the absence of such a beautiful likeness, the frenzy of Lipps's descriptions makes clear that even his notes cannot quite convey the force of the objects cataloged in the book. And having seen them for the first time myself last night, I understand a little better how and why this had to be the case. At every moment, Lipps's text conveys his certitude that the objects have power, and he longs to be the master of their force, to make them work a kind of politico-therapeutic magic against the fascist tendencies of his moment. In this respect, as we know, he failed. But that does not mean that his efforts had no effect. The Savage Hits Back is an odd, brave, descriptively verbose, theoretically slender, generically transgressive anachronism of a book. It is discontinuous with almost everything else that was being written in its moment. If you think just of what was happening in philosophy, Husserl had published The Crisis of the European Sciences and Transcendental Phenomenology in 1936. Wittgenstein was writing his philosophical investigation. Heidegger's Introduction to Metaphysics had appeared in 1935. Sartre published The Transcendence of the Ego in that same year that Lipps published The Savage Hits Back. And then in the social sciences, too, the book was discontinuous. Michel Lery, Georges Bataille, and Roger Caillois were founding the Collège de Sociologie. Lery had published L'Afrique Fantôme, detailing the Dakar-Djibouti mission of 1931-3, 3 years previously, staking his own claim on critical primitivism. So much for the monuments of a certain European modernism, to which Lipps's book is at best a footnote. In anthropology, Ruth Benedict had published Patterns of Culture in 1934, and Evans Pritchard's The Witchcraft, Oracles, and Magic Among the Azandi arrived almost simultaneously with The Savage Hits Back. Lipps's book was as remote from Benedict's Gestaltism as it was from Evans Pritchard's structural functionalism, and shared nothing with their commitment to the analysis of cultural totalities, although his later writing on Law Among the Naskapi indicates that he was to be transformed by his engagement with Boasian thought and by Melville Herskovitz's work on acculturation and African Americanity. But what about the literatures of the anti-colonial intellectuals? In that same year of The Savage Hits Back, the Nigerian journalist Nnamdi Azikiwe published his Renaissance Africa, partly inspired by Alain Locke's concept of the New Negro. A veritable manifesto of pacifist liberation, Renaissance Africa advocated a pan-Africanist rejuvenation of the entire continent. Azikiwe paid lip service to Marx, but his contemporary, W.E.B. Du Bois, from whom we derive the concept of double consciousness, was an ardent communist as well as a pan-Africanist, and he had published his monumental tome, Black Reconstruction in America, in 1935. George Padmore had published How Britain Rules Africa and Africa and World Peace in 36 and 37, respectively. And I will leave aside what was coming out of Asia. What strikes one now is how little contact there was between what I am somewhat indiscriminately yoking together as two distinct intellectual traditions. And of course, Sartre's engagement with black radicalism was still to come. I narrate these two political tracks, or these two parallel tracks, which are also political tracks, of Lipps's contemporaneity, not to remark the discontinuity between his work and that of his milieu, but to introduce the situation in which he was writing as one of a gross non-communication between the literatures, in which the colonized were deemed a source and object of knowledge, and those that were the product of black and other racialized subjects. But let us return to Lipps to understand the reason, not for its dismissal of black radical thought, but for its generic and conceptual exceptionalism. And the first thing to say, as many of you know, is that it was written as a polemic, not from within the protocols of art historical or anthropological discourse. The objects described are read as instances of a type, and they emerge in a progression born of Lipps's efforts to project himself into the place of the colonized, which is then materialized in the dramaturgy of his text. After two chapters that provide a methodological introduction and rationale, the book is organized thematically and in the order of their appearance in and for those who would later represent the colonial Europeans. First, ships, then the arrival of Europeans. Chapter 4 concerns the white man in the mass. 5 is addressed to commodities, objects, and things of power. Then come missionaries and new concepts of divinity, after which the white merchant, but also money, are introduced. We then get a litany of the social types of bureaucratized colonial society, namely the official, teacher, doctor, judge, explorer. Finally, the colonial woman arrives, followed by the chieftains and figures of white political authority. If considered from the side of the colonized, this progression extends in time and moves forward in proximity. It is an approach and an invasion from afar. There is, of course, a moral political reason for Lipp's polemic, which might be summarized as follows: to make primitivism the antidote to civilized barbarism. And this much has been said by many. But if we start at the end of the book, where Lipp explains the relative paucity of figurations of white women by native artisans, we learn something interesting. Women were, for Lipp, defined by their relationship to fashion, that system of up-to-dateness in which the function of the woman is to display modernity as the escape from obsolescence. She is the one who, being supposedly most liable to revert to the primordial forces of nature, must labor most vigorously to escape them. The woman, in other words, is modernity's timekeeper. Lipps writes, and I quote, "It was impossible to make a permanently true picture of her. Even among native women, changing times brought changes in coiffure and preferences for individual colors or decorations. But the European woman was a perplexing labyrinth of changes. Her gown shapes and waistlines, hats and fans, displayed variations without end, for their mistress was the slave of secrets that reached her from foreign realms of civilization, the Paris and Vienna fashions." Eventually, the European woman became metonymically representable as the wearer of a skirt. And it is with respect to the difficulty of representing the white woman that Lipps discloses the logic of the colonial figurations he has described, namely their emblematic nature. This is not a function. This is not a function of any supposed native tendency to iconicization. It emerges from the nature of that kind of militarized masculinity at the heart of colonialism. The uniform and the weapon are available as signifiers of whiteness because, Lipps argues, the white man of colonialism is specifically the white man of the mass. Now, the strange thing about this claim is that it is accompanied by another statement that attributes to the so-called primitive artisan a capacity to see through the self-iconicizing gestures of the military mass subject, indicated by the uniform, and to find something else, a detail that is enabled to speak precisely because it appears on a surface that is otherwise entirely typified. In one of the most remarkable statements in the book, Lipps writes, "The white man in general is only a pattern. However strange it may sound, it was primitive man's anonymous and impersonal power of imagery that restored to the foreign intruder the qualities which the white man in the mass had lost centuries before, a peculiar mint mark and individual personality." It is, I believe, this strange power that Lipps was seeking for his critical project, a power to break through the forces of serialization and massification that subtended National Socialism. This power to restore the singularity that is the basis of all ethical relation, to restore it against the death drive of totalitarianism, has received less attention than the critical and alienating capacity of the figures when they are construed as materializations of a return gaze whose primary function is the exposure rather than the remedy of violence. In figures understood as an expression of mockery, it is less the magically transformative potency of the object than the alienating laughter heard emanating from it that matters. If the figures had had the therapeutic capacity that Lipps seemed to believe is enabled by the artistry of the sculptor, they would be functioning in the way that Evans Pritchard said all magic functions, by privileging the singular above the general, the event above the conditions of possibility of its occurrence. And we cannot pursue that argument here. What I want to consider instead is how the gaze conceived as alienation, came first to dominate the thought of the colonized representations in the wake of Lipps's intervention, and then to be displaced. The return gaze was conceived as the redoubling of the epistemic structure of the colonial gaze, a source of objectification and exposure. In the light of this gaze, as it were, this gaze misrecognized as the very source of truth, the colonizer would be made transparent, but not necessarily changed. When later a certain phenomenological anthropology returned to consider the force of objects, such as those collected by Lipps, the representations of whiteness were read as expressions of an effort to appropriate its power. Thus, Michael Taussig, in Mimesis and Alterity, describes the magical, soulful power that derives from replication in itself, and goes on to wonder about the kuna healing figurines, or nuchukana, which were, following colonization, made in the image of Europeans, that is to say, as the big O, other. Taussig uses the capital O here, implying that the figures were efforts to give form to radical alterity, not just a general otherness, even as he finds his own image as a European type reflected there. Surprised by this fact, and by the language in which the rite is conducted, which Taussig admits he doesn't understand, he nonetheless thrills to the possibility that mimicry will corrode, as he says, the alterity by which his science is nourished. In a variety of places, have I lost a file here? In a variety of places, he finds the same phenomeno non-logic at play. The important point about what I call the magic of mimesis is the same, namely that, in some way or another, the making and existence of the artifact that portrays something gives one power over that which is portrayed. Lipps makes an appearance in Mimesis and Alterity, but only in a footnote in the last chapter. And it is significant that it is invoked at the point where Taussig is calling for a novel anthropology, not of the third and other worlds, but of the West itself as mirrored in the eyes and handiwork of its others. The point is to relinquish the love of and drive toward mastery, a goal with which I sympathize, if not via this method. The reason for this, given by Taussig, is that world history has decreed otherwise. Mastery is mocked as first world and other worlds now mirror, interlock, and rupture each other's alterity to such a degree that all that is left is the excess, the self-consciousness as to the novel need for an identity, sexual, racial, ethnic and national, and the roller coastering violence and enjoyment of this state of affairs. Mockery, in Lipps's sense, is thus displaced by mimesis, which has made a mockery of reason. In the writing of someone like Homi Bhabha, this mimesis was signified as resistance, but the logic of the gaze remained intact. Bhabha was careful to insist that the mimicry that generates hybridity produces something that is not quite not white. Taussig restores the binary in order to dissolve it. Nonetheless, the theoretical progression that moves from the kinds of power of the kuna healing figure to the situation in which reason is mocked reproduces but also inverts the order of the historical process outlined by Lipps. He begins by asserting that while the relation of the white to the colored world down the centuries has been that of exploiter and exploited, the colored world has, in its different branches and at different periods, pronounced varying sentence on the white man. As the anthropological legend goes, whites were initially greeted as despectralized ancestral figures, and sometimes as ghosts or spirits, And their powers, most especially their fire powers, were both feared and desired. But, Lips adds, the impressions of the white man's superior power did not last long. The natives began to know him better and ceased devising tales which would explain his superiority. They soon found out that the white man was only another species of the human race. When they became familiar with him as a human being, they treated him to their mockery exactly as they did any member of their own tribe, especially when they recognized his weaknesses. So let me parse this as follows. Mockery ends when power has faded because known. It is not the other of knowing, but its outcome. This is perhaps what led Malinowski to read Lips's account of the derisive colonial figurines, if that is what they were, as a form of laughter denuded of the violence of the joke, as in Freud's sense. Indeed, if Malinowski extolled Lips's project when he wrote the introduction to the book, he also neutralized it. Here is Malinowski's introduction. Anthropology is the science of the sense of humor. It can thus be defined without too much pretension or facetiousness. For to see ourselves as others see us is but the reverse and the counterpart of the gift to see others as they really are and as they want to be. By this criterion, writes Malinowski, according to which anthropology be defined as the art and craft in the sense of humor, then The Savage Hits Back is one of the first contributions to real anthropology, first in rank, and first in priority of time. Without facetiousness, without mockery, which is to say in all seriousness, the anthropologist will be recognized in his whiteness from elsewhere, from the place of the other, not as other, big O other, as Taussig suggests, not as the divine or the phallic source of all recognition, but as one among others. So far, so good. But Malinowski goes further. In seeing how others see us, the anthropologist will receive an image, indeed an imago, of what others want to be. Not what they want to be seen as, but what they want to be. And we are left with a question. How would that work? How would the image of oneself as merely another and not as the other disclose what others want to be, no longer for the other, but in themselves? Malinowski seems to imply, perhaps in ways that he himself did not realize, that the drive inherent in the representation of colonial Europeans is the drive to entirely eliminate the desire for recognition within the dialectic of domination that was coloniality. A door opens, and then it closes. Malinowski is ambivalent, cannot fully pursue this insight. He returns to a certain kind of laughter, if we may borrow the title of Eleanor Smith Bowen's 1954 anthropological novel. Not laughing, that experience of profane possession and dispossession in which the body has a life of its own, but laughter, the concept of corporeal breach that has been concluded and sealed over. Malinowski thought that Lips had accomplished this newly discovered disciplinary task by inquiring into the vision of white humanity as held by the native. Like Freud in Thoughts for the Times on War and Death, he adduces another example of reverse anthropology by reproducing the possibly, probably, apocryphal story of an old cannibal who, upon hearing news of the Great War, asked how Europeans managed to eat such enormous quantities of human flesh, as the casualties of the battle seemed to imply. When told that they do not consume the corpses of their slain enemies, the cannibal evinces, quote, real horror, and asks, what sort of barbarians kill without any real object? The cannibal thus ascends to the position of diagnostician of civilized barbarism and gives to the anthropologist the form and alibi for a critique of mass death in industrialized warfare. Hardly the kind of thing about which one jokes. And yet one can hear a gentle laugh burbling up, as Malinowski writes, thinking perhaps of the cocktail party at which a tale about the sagacity of a cannibal can summon the ghost of Montaigne. Some reviewers echoed Malinowski's readings. A writer for the Science newsletter observed that for years, white men have been staring at natives and making frank remarks about how funny they are. But the tables have been turned. If you can take it, you can see how funny white men look to the natives. Others did not share the enthusiasm and even accused Lips of lacking a sense of humor. Charles T. Loram went further and expressed contempt for the politicization of the anthropological project. With reference to the Africans, at least with whom the writer of this review has had a lifelong experience, it is extremely doubtful if what Professor Lips regards as caricatures of the white man are much more than the struggle of the poorly equipped artist with his difficult material. Still others combined an accusation of exaggeration with a comment on Lips's failure to realize the full depth of political destitution experienced by the colonized makers of these figures. Ellsworth Farris, for example, wrote that witticisms, derisive proverbs, and derogatory carvings can hardly be cited as evidence of revolt. They resemble, rather, the muttered curses of those who cannot hit back because they are powerless. Dr. Lips would have liked to hit back, but all he could do was to flee from Cologne to Paris and then to America. And since he could not hit back, he prints his pictures. It is a rather feeble blow. The savage is not hitting back. Finally, there were accusations of overreading. Loram added to his condescending review the following observation: that the Europeanized and sophisticated African does at times make fun of the white man, imitating his speech, his gait, and other eccentricities, is true, but to suggest, for example, that in his representation of the French soldier in Dahomey, the African intended to convey the incarnation of crass obedience, of military discipline, of unreasoning submission, of the stiff execution of warrants devised and issued by another, is unscientific. You get a sense of that dilation of which I was speaking. He's quoting Lips. It is easy to dismiss this accusation, coming as it does from a writer whose own racism suffuses the review. It may therefore be useful to turn here to the writings of Namdi Azikiwe, whose Africa Renaissance I mentioned earlier. They suggest something about the frame within which Lips was reading. When Lips described the English fright figure number 56 that I showed you, he did not limit himself to the visible world. Quote, above the coat, which fastens high up, the head is visible, and its wide open mouth with tongue and huge teeth seemed to be shouting the word halt. As I said, Lips considered the soldier to be a specific kind of signifier, not of whiteness per se, but of the white man in the mass. At times, the artist is said to have conferred recognition on the military man's inhabitation of rank splendor. But at other times, and especially by virtue of the figure's appearance in an assemblage, Lips found something else. The aforementioned incarnation of crass obedience, of military discipline, of unreasoning submission, of the stiff execution of commands devised and issued by another. This was the description that irked Loram, as you've seen. In hearing the word halt emanating from the toothy mouth of the Englishman, however, Lips believes he had discerned what the native artist had discerned, namely the Englishman as the bearer of law, as prohibition. Halt. Come no further, go no further. The spirit might flee such an injunction, but in the bright light of geopolitical day, the one who says halt demands fixity. He is the policer of borders, the speaking vessel of territorial power, and the secret medium of taxidermic tendencies. The one who responds is ideologically interpolated, psychically captated. How interesting, then, to note that when the pacifist, Ezekwe, speaks of the soldier in colonial context as part of an effort to interrogate the ideology of glory within which the youth of every nation had been summoned to die, he offers a rather different sequence of readings. There is a leader, he writes, a captain who tells a sergeant what to do. The soldier reasons not. The soldier asks no question. The soldier dares not to retreat in the face of fire from the opposing lines without the order of the commander. And then Ezekwe continues, advance is the word. We have to be careful, of course. Ezekwe is not reading the English fright figure, but that phenomenon of which Lipps believes he is a part and emblem, and which he has demanded the colonized subject serve. Nonetheless, for Ezekwe, power exercises itself in the command to keep moving, to go forward, even in the face of death, to produce, to walk into death. Not halt, but do not stop. It is on this basis, and lamenting the absence of the Nazarene doctrine in the colonized world, that Ezekwe argues, in a gesture that nonetheless resonates with what Lipps seeks in the inversive gaze, that the most atrocious barbarity against humanity was committed by mankind in order to make the world safe for democracy. The sentiment is echoed and updated in the far more sophisticated analysis of colonized consciousness in Fanon's Peau Noire, Masque Blanc. There, Fanon quotes Césaire's discourse on colonialism. Yes, says Fanon, European civilization and its agents of the highest caliber are responsible for colonial racism. It is not an aberration. He then quotes Césaire, and then one fine day, the bourgeoisie is awakened by a terrific boomerang effect. The Gestapos are busy, the prisons fill up, the torturers standing around the racks invent, refine, discuss. But note here that Philcox has translated choc en retour as boomerang. Now, the boomerang implies a coming back, to be sure, but not necessarily a shock, nor is it necessarily terrifying. By contrast, in the text of Césaire's political speech, also quoted by Fanon, Hitler is represented as a spectral presence haunting America, South Africa, and everywhere that there is anti-Semitism. Lynchings, forced labor, and pogroms are the form of that ghostly appearance, that concrete reapparition, that refusal to die, to outlast all others, as Canetti argues. Here, then, is the enunciation of the boomerang effect as seen from the space of an anticipated decolonization. In Philcox's rendition, however, we can recognize a certain neutralization in translation, a neutralization that is not unrelated to Malinowski's reduction of laughing to laughter and a good sense of humor. But we should not confuse Malinowski's broad-minded and broad-mouthed self-comfort with Lipps's account. Both Lipps and Ezekwe adduced the concept of the boomerang or the return in relation to Oswald Spengler's argument about the decline of Western civilization. Lipps thought that Spengler had misrecognized the nature of a possible black anti-colonial movement by thinking that it would take the form of a black proletariat led by white adventurers. Instead, Lipps thought race would provide the organizational concept of that insurrection. And he added, for adventurers to lead the attack, we have not to look very far. It is none other than Adolf Hitler himself who has given the black and yellow world of the war, who have given the black and yellow world the war cry for the settlement of racial issues with the white world. Hitler has given the colored races their future battle cry. His race theory, raked from the dusty folios of Gobineau and Chamberlain, may prove to be the mightiest boomerang in the world's history. Lipps's boomerang, I'm suggesting that there are many boomerangs. Lipps's boomerang is thus not simply the return to Europe of the violence that it perpetrated in and through colonialism, the wages of sin, as it were, as it was for Césaire. Rather, white supremacy gives to the colonized the means to oppose colonialism, but on the condition of their own racialization. We should say re-racialization, but either way, it is an ambivalent inheritance. When Azikiwe invoked Spengler, he was writing the preface to Renaissance Africa in early 1937 at the Trocadero Hotel, no kidding, in Accra. The preface ends as follows. "For all I know," said George Bernard Shaw, "the next great civilization may come from the Negro race." Azikiwe then adds, "This prophecy is enough for me, unless one cares to read Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West." Sick. As it happens, Shaw's remarks were greeted with suspicion by journalists who were interviewing him following his address to an audience of 3,500 at Carnegie Hall in 1933. The Times journalist, at least, thought he was joking, that his response to their questions was more an occasion for him to display his wit than anything, a form of intellectual calisthenics. Azikiwe certainly knew that Shaw's statement had been read in this way, and yet his determination to bend it to his purposes, literalizing Shaw's words and refusing the joke in order to have the last laugh, suggests an altogether different way of thinking about the forms of reading white supremacist discourse from the perspective of black radical critique. And in the time that remains, I want to explore that question of reading. If we were to trace the future history, or rather a future history, of some of the aesthetic traditions within which the white Europeans were figured in Africa, we might want to consider the work of someone like Johanna Sekehola, a South African artist from Limpopo. His sculpture certainly includes depictions of whites, but it is the angelic figures It is the angelic figures bearing cameras as they look upon the white devils, I said white devils, who are nonetheless black, that deserves our attention. For these spectral figures, whose prosthetic eyes substitute for the oversight of a truly omniscient god, provides a perfect materialization of the specular relay suggested by the inverse gaze. That gaze has become a part object, a detachable organ, an eye camera. It is the instrument of a judgment, but a deferred one, as well perhaps as a useless one, insofar as the final judgment permits no further transformation. Sekehola's terrifying image in the tableau entitled The Devil's Party, in which two devils are roasting a man on a spit, seems to code evil as black. But in fact, these black devils are white, or rather whites. And throughout Sekehola's oeuvre, they are identified with the masters of apartheid. We therefore do not need to know that in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which opened after the sculpture was made, it was revealed that this torture was in fact undertaken by South African defense forces against suspected MK guerrillas. And such a gesture of grounding the work in the historical real inevitably reduces it, negates its work as art, negates the work whose purpose is to engage the imagination as a supplement to reason. Is this not one of the risks of the critique of the inverse gaze, that we lose the objects by repeating the gesture of reading them as mere mirrors for a moral revision of the colonizer's subjectivity? And is this not also the risk of reading African art today? This is no joke. Let us consider another case, another alternative exercise in reading, These figures in which the artist Samson Kambalu has crafted objects in which he gives to be seen the image of African soldiers as they gave themselves to be seen by colonial authorities. Kambalu doesn't merely see others being seen, nor sees himself being seen by others. He has given these to be seen, and not least by the market. Even so, the market does not exhaust the work, even if it orients it. And this is as true for the figures discussed by Lips as for the work by someone like Kambalu. Nonetheless, there are times when the market seems to mortify the imagination. What shall we say of works like these ones in the tourist market of a Johannesburg shopping mall? The hastily mass-produced cliches which reproduce the types of figures of which Lips was so fond and that are in their most beautiful forms are installed next door here. These hastily mass-produced cliches stand sightless, mocking the idea of a possible power within. But then perhaps this too is a reverse gaze, an exposure of the mortifying powers of the tourist art market and of the relentless self-exposure that it demands. Now, oops, I'm missing a blank, we'll sit there. That question of what happens when culture becomes that which is given to be seen in the image of authenticity is at the heart of a wonderful novel by Zeyx Nda called The Heart of Redness. This novel provides us with what I believe is an alternative form of thinking, the legacy, and the problem of the inverse gaze. Nda's novel is a reading and a rewriting of a verily mythified event in South African history, namely the great cattle killing of 1856-7. That event arose in the context of extremely bloody frontier wars between the British government of the Cape Colony and the Amatxosa people of the Eastern Cape. At that time, a young orphaned girl woman, a young girl on the verge of her sexual maturity named Nonkosi, is said to have received visions from ancestral spirits who told her that her people must kill their cattle and burn their corn, following which they would defeat the British and the ancestors would return. Hers was not the first prophecy of this sort, and in fact it repeated elements in a long tradition. Yet her visions acquired great force. The British of the time accused the Xhosa chiefs of faking the prophecy in order to thwart them. The Xhosa chiefs accused the British of planting the rumors of prophecy as a means to commit genocide. The Xhosa people were themselves divided about the status of the prophecy. But in the end, statistics suggest that up to 2/3 of the population died of starvation within 6 months. The political sovereignty of the nation was entirely eviscerated, and the terrible consequences of the event were worsened when food aid was provided on condition that the recipients agree to become wage laborers for the missions and colonial government. This catastrophe remains an enigma today, etched in monuments, woven into tapestries, metaphorized in narratives of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. In 1989, the historian J.B. Pérez published an extraordinary historical narrative of the events called The Dead Will Arise. Criticized by some, it nonetheless quickly came to occupy the place that memory might have played were the history of the Amatxosa not so violently interrupted. Now, this kind of story is tragically common in the colonized world, not only with respect to the violent interruption of the traditions within which inheritance would otherwise take place, but also with respect to the dependency that contemporary subjects then have on the archival record, which must function as the impossible substitute for experience and its memory. Now, one could say that this structure makes of the colonized memory in the aftermath of radical trauma an imitation of the archive, a mimicry of a representation of an absent knowledge. And that is precisely the kind of statement that Anda aimed to displace with his novel. And immediately upon its publication, Da was accused of plagiarizing Pires's text, of being so derivative as to be a mere copyist, someone merely attempting to appropriate the power of the historian. Both he and Pires rejected this accusation. Yet the suspicions remained. The trope of colonial mimicry is its own boomerang, it turns out. Let us then look at how the text works to learn from it, how to think the legacy of colonialism beyond the specular relay. I'm hoping you can see that, but I'm going to read it to you. Here is the opening page of Pires's text. Mlanjeni, the riverman, was about 18 years old in 1850, and so weak and emaciated from fasting that he could not walk about unaided. The power of evil so pervaded the world, he thought, that it inhabited even the homestead of his father Kala and poisoned even his mother's cooking. In order to keep himself pure and undefiled, Mlanjeni withdrew from the society of men and spent much of his time alone. Most especially, he liked to go up to his neck in water for hours, some say days, subsisting only on ants' eggs, water grass, and other foods of nature. He greatly feared the debilitating power of women, and kept himself strictly celibate. Now here is Nda's narration of the same so-called facts. Mlanjeni, the man of the river. He was only 18, yet his head was not yet full of maidens. It did not throb with stick fights and umchocho dances. Instead, he brooded over the evil that pervaded the world, that lurked even in the house of his own father, Kala. As a result, he refused to eat his mother's cooking, for he said it was poisoned. He decided to fast because food enervated him. Women had an enfeebling power on him, so he kept himself celibate. So an initial glance shows a great deal of apparent resemblance. And yet the differences are significant, but especially because they emerge in the space of the apparent resemblance. Pires is writing in the idiom of disciplinary historiography. Ages and dates locate us. These signify differently for the two writers. For Pires, the young man's celibacy is functioned in the pursuit of purity as preparation for a prophetic role. In Mda, sexuality is in question. The man is only 18. He is not yet possessed by desire. Pires, whose scholarship is as profound as it is generous, nonetheless does not so much imagine the interiority of the young man as he claims to know it. He thought, writes Pires, he thought. Pires knows what he thought. The free and direct discourse of Mda's text presumes something else, for this is now a character in a novel, not the historical reel. Indeed, how could it be? Mda has only Pires's text in place of that reel. This is his tragedy. His response is to show his readers with repeated and emphatic gestures that he knows that this is his predicament. That we are all dependent on the archive is not the point, of course, for here the archive sutures over a gap that is the space of historical trauma, the interruption of alternative sources, and the origin of a double bind. Tragedy for Mda is that he cannot not want those archives. The comedy lies in his transcendence of them. Page after page, Mda shows this to us. In the passages decided here, he is also inaugurating a strategy of seeming autoethnography. The Iziklosa words appear in italics, again showing themselves to the reader. They are accompanied by glosses in many cases, but not all cases, leading the English-only reader to feel that these are lexical gifts and pearls of cultural insight. The italics disappear after the second iteration, however, and as this occurs, other phrases enter, which are glosses of words that never appear in either isiXhosa or any other Southern African language. Secrets are being told but not revealed. This is especially true of the phrases that are used to describe white people, such as those that metonymize it with a reference to the translucent or reflective ear. They are translations of various idioms and proverbs from the historical poetry of the colonial era. But if one does not know this, their very status as glosses remains invisible. Now, the encounter with the history of Nonkawusi is focalized through a character, Kamago, who is triply exiled. He is first exiled from his own tradition, thanks to the events of the cattle killing, the catastrophe whose immediate survivors are known as the middle generations. He then goes into exile as an opponent of apartheid, moving to the United States, becoming more and more cut off from the concerns of his natal community. Finally, when he returns to South Africa, he finds himself without knowledge of the struggle, including its performative traditions, such as Toitoing, and is thus excluded from the privileged class of struggle aristocracy, among whom the fruits of the new dispensation are being distributed. Everything in the novel has a double, the past characters having their namesakes in the present, the relationship to prophecy being redoubled in the belief or not in the value of tradition, which in the new era can only be valorized in the medium of cultural tourism. In the novel, this industry is being proposed as part of a development program that includes a casino, but both are going to capitalize on the location's proximity to the place at which the young prophet, Nonkawusi, supposedly first received her inspirational visions or hearings. I've shown you a passage of the text which establishes in the overt manner in which it gives itself to be seen that the resemblance between Peres's text and Ndaa's is one of intertextuality rather than mere citationality or mimesis. There are numerous other such announcements in the text. And indeed, it seems constantly to say, look at me, I am looking back at the canon, which is also mine. The title of the novel is, of course, an invocation of Conrad's Heart of Darkness. But lest there be any doubt about it, Ndaa puts the following words in the mouth of Sir Harry Smith. Quote, extermination is now the only word and principle that guides us. I loved these people and considered them my children. But now I say exterminate the savage beasts, he told his field commanders. Some of them were seen marching to war with the word extermination emblazoned on their hats. End quote. Now, the real historical Sir Harry Smith was known in South Africa not only for his brutality, but for demanding that he be called Nkosi Nkulu, King of the Chiefs. Not only this, but he demanded that the other chiefs treat him as such by putting his boot on their necks and making them kiss his feet. We could read this in the manner of Michael Tausig's reading of the deranged mimesis of the rubber plantation authorities in the Putumayo as white people imitating the savagery that they project onto their enemies. But Ndaa offers us an alternative reading. He is concerned to show that the demand made of the colonized is that of literalization. Harry Smith's desire is that his name be treated not as a metaphor but as the truth. The strategy is repeated throughout the novel as characters are constantly being surprised or caught by the actuality of a power that is literalizing itself. Thus, for example, a character called Bonko experiences the scars of history as actual scars erupting on his back and itching. On the one hand, this moment invokes a comparable scene in George Orwell's Burmese Days, a writer eminently concerned with the experience of being mocked by the colonized, you'll recall. It also invokes the moment in Toni Morrison's Beloved, when Sethi's scars are revealed as a tree-like image on her back, this image being itself an invocation of the famous photograph of the slave Oliver taken in 1863. But the scars are events for Bonko, not representations or symbols or metaphors. Kamago, too, is beset by the realness of the ancestors. He is surprised when a snake, the totem of a familial clan of which he is entirely ignorant, appears. And so are the residents of the community who otherwise believe in such things. Belief and disbelief fail to explain the individual's vulnerability to the eruption of the historical real, for the subject does not merely inherit information from the past. Yet the contemporary Amakosa in the novel are also alienated from this history. It doesn't come when summoned, and they even consider purchasing a trance rite from another group, the abattoir or san, in order to enable better access to the ancestral realm. When that fails, they debate whether cultural tourism can save them and restore what they have otherwise forgotten, or whether it will merely reduce them to the kinds of beings who exist to be looked at. Nda offers us a final, exquisite narrativization of this dilemma and its origins, but also possibly an exit. Once again, he's in a relation of intertextuality with Perez. Here's Perez. La Casa and most of the other residents of the prophetic homestead died of starvation, but the prophetess herself survived and was handed over to Major Gawler by the chief of the Bomvana. She stayed with the Gawlers for a while, and one day, Mrs. Gawler dressed her up together with Nonkosi, the Mpongo prophetess, and Dr. Fitzgerald took them down to the photographer where the stolid portrait reproduced in this book was taken. And there you see it. And here is Nda. Mrs. Gawler tries to teach them the rudiments of good grooming. They are immersed in a bathtub, and she sees to it that they scrub their sacred bodies with pebbles and wash themselves thoroughly with soap and water until the layers of dirt have peeled off. She dresses them nicely in colorful dresses, young prophets in summer dresses. She and Dr. Fitzgerald, the miracle doctor that the man who named Ten Rivers brought from New Zealand, takes the prophetesses to a photographic studio for their portrait. "Smile, Nonkos," she says. Click. "Come on, Nongozi, don't be so sullen. Smile." Click. These prophets, not only do they not know how to fall, they do not know how to smile either. Click. Now, what you need to know to grasp this scene is that Isikosa is a language with clicks. They are represented with three diacritics, X for C for and Q for. Nonkosi's name, as you have heard, is pronounced with a click that Mrs. Gawler does not or cannot recognize and will not speak. The disappearance of the clicks, which we can read as the narrativization of a failure to listen, is simultaneous in this novel with the camera's mechanical sounding. This instrument that reduces relation to looking and which therefore figures the kinds of psychic economy from which the entire discourse of the return gaze derives its force, is here the instrument of a theft, an abduction. In this scenario, it terminates the relay. And indeed, it comes at the end of a miniature narrative in which the children have been instructed in how to simulate death. For this narrative, however, Mda does not depend on Perez. A white woman is teaching them Ring a Ring of Rosies. Mrs. Gawler finds them quite amusing, although they can't get the hang of the simplest games. She is teaching them beautiful children's songs that celebrate death. Ring a ring of roses, a pocket full of posies. Hashu, atshu, we all fall down. These children, these prophets, they do not know how to fall down. They do it so artlessly, so gracelessly, so crudely. The free indirect discourse gives us Mrs. Gawler's point of view, but Mda's narrator implicitly asks, what would play have been here but escape from the literal, which was also caused by a certain literalization? The girls cannot escape this history any more than Mda can. He depends on Perez, but unlike them, he is not. The text that gives itself to be read by the English-only reader is not the same as the text that is given to be read by the bilingual Isikosa English reader. So, Reader, beware. Beware with Fanon the presumptive unicity in the discourse of the return gaze, the native, the white, the African. Mda's ideal bilingual reader must come to the doubled address through English, for it works only in the space between. But that reader will also know, or can detect, the other main intertext here, namely a famous novel by S.E.K. Nkai Itiala Lamawela, The Lawsuit of the Twins. This text is implicated on the opening page in the reference to a genealogy at the head of which is Kikla, or Hinsa, as the English called him, the headless ancestor. Immediately beneath the chief's names are the designations Twin and Twin-Twin. Itiala Lamawela was the first novel in his Ixhosa, and it concerns the judgment of a chief whose twin sons are competing for an inheritance. One has been wrongly marked as the firstborn at birth. Both sons believe they are rightful heirs, and in the end, the biological firstborn is granted this status, but the more talented secondborn is also recognized, and both come to believe that the other is a superior candidate for leadership. Mda's inheritance of this text, widely read as a rhetorical masterpiece in defense of tradition, is worked throughout the novel in the historically recurrent characters named Twin and Twin-Twin, but it is also invoked in the discussion of Itiala, which in the contemporary context has come to mean the contract for a loan and thus credit, as well as the judgment on debt. The English-only reader can learn this by submitting to the protocols of the text, by bending her imagination in its direction. This is what we get from the pleasure of this text, which announces without disclosing its secrets. Those secrets call for a reading and a listening and lead to a change in the reader quite independently of any copying. Or rather, it occurs when one relinquishes the notion of the copy as the model for change in the seemingly impossible space opened by colonialism. That parallel track of which I spoke when invoking two distinct textual traditions cannot be altered with mimesis, nor negated by an inversive gaze. Mda offers us a way of learning to do otherwise. It would be wrong, of course, to call this Mda's last laugh. There is no last laugh, not before the end. But then, as Peter Abrahams suggests, it might return as something other than mockery. And here is Abrahams, who was the first Black South African novelist to write of the mine compounds, a poem from 1940. Man's laughter is dead. I have been awakened by strange machines wiping laughter forever from the eyes of my regimented brothers, remember the soldiers, but also the miners. I have learnt to be burningly with the fiercest fire, and I have discarded my humility and the will of God and the stories of my wise teachers, arming myself with the wretchedness in every plain man's life, and all the tomorrows, my soldiers, I battle on behalf of that freedom that will restore the laughter of man. Thank you for your attention. And I know we know time for questions.
Do you want to take some questions? Because we would have five.
If there are questions, I'm happy to take them. I know we're very, very pressured. Erhard, if I can see well enough to. Erhard, did you want to? Sorry, waiting for a mic.
Yes, it's a question. Maybe it's also just I'm being puzzled, because if I take these two talks together, because they're both about South Africa, I totally agree with the first talk about the critique of wax figures and of representations of the Bleak and Lloyd people with rock art. And of course, on the other hand, I see that in the different arts that deal with these circumstances and these histories, different techniques of wax arts are returning. I don't know if this kind of fiction is not like a wax art too, because it paints, and it paints out certain things that are missing and in our minds. So I'd rather ask the question if documentation is not the best we can do about these things, instead of making new fictions, new enhancements, and new rock art paintings out of what we have. And the histories of violence, I mean, if we take violence literally, then we can only do documentation, basically, and restoration too. And that's why this is a painful question for me, if not in the different arts, not colonial, but post-colonial wishes return that deal with the, of course, with the wish to heal something that cannot be healed. And I think I stop here.
So my understanding is that these are entirely distinct questions. The task of the fiction writer, the task of the artist, is to cultivate the imagination in the interest of change, not to be bound, to be captated in the museological mode, which has its purpose, and indeed it on which it must depend in some very profound way. But the task of the artist is something else. It is not, I mean, we are in the time, of course, when a great deal of art is documentary in its aspiration and its method. And one sees, in fact, the gallery spaces being, and everything in them, being re-signified every time that a piece of documentary art enters into that space. You know, if you're in a gallery of photographic and videographic work and there's something by forensic architecture, the question asked of every piece in there will be about its informational content. I do not see that as the totality of what art should, could, or wants to do. And my sense is that one of the ambitions of someone like Mda, who is dependent upon, in a way that pains him, who is dependent upon the archive, is indeed to try and imagine. It's an impossible task, you know, Marx says, the revolution requires that one takes one's poetry from the future to imagine things otherwise. So these don't seem to me to be mutually exclusive agendas or projects at all. I mean, to the extent that there are artworks, aesthetic practices that seem to replicate or to deploy the techniques which in another moment and in another context were used in museological purposes, the question maybe becomes muddied. But I would not that, for myself, and I think for people like Nda or many of the other artists that I've spoken to, I don't think that they would want to be confined to that task. I know that's probably not a satisfying answer to you, but that is how I would respond. And that, in my opinion, is the lesson of reading Nda.
If I can just very briefly add to that, the memory of Nonkose in South African history, of course, brings up Sir George Grey. Oh, because sure. In that story of the
plotter.
Of the prophecy, which was recounted at Koloha on the coast, was that George Grey, the colonial governor, was hiding in the bush, and that this was an invented prophecy that was instructed to Nkosi to recount, and so that there is an instrumental understanding of that history of how the cattle killing led to the killing of so many people. And in Perez's version, Perez gives an account of a psychological truth, and that is not an empirical truth. And for making that argument one day in front of our assembled students, the students took him apart, and he had this extremely traumatic experience, which probably led to him leaving the academy, because by then he became a member of parliament and so forth. But the question of the copy and of wax figures, not so much wax figures, I mean it's wax, but it's also made as an exact record of the body. There's one aspect of my presentation that I think links with this, which I decided to omit because I thought I was running out of time. And that is that in the laboratory of the desert, the young daughter of Kanaku, Klein Kanaku, enacts a dance which the anthropologists document as tradition. That in the middle of the dance, what she does is mimic the work of the scientists and their measuring instruments and their camera, and incorporates these, essentially I see as a, not an imitative act, but an act of parody and of critique of, I suppose, the rituals of science, which then get read as tradition and as a lacking of history. And so it's very interesting for us to think of these different forms of copy, of mimesis, of referencing, and of critique that is happening in these multiple genres of representation.
Yeah, I mean, that's a classic example of the return gaze. Yeah, I mean, this is sort of moving towards Rush and Le Mieux-Tourfou and so forth, except that it's highly reflective and so forth. But I mean, I think the lesson of Mda is that there can be at least two signifying chains active in that kind of a performance. One can either read it as the kind of critical copy, the parody, or one can, and you know, I mean, Mda is showing you this, my text looks like Perez's text. And yet, you know, if you are willing to listen, if you are willing to accept the protocols it gives you for reading, if you are willing to recognize this kind of abundant intertextuality that is not reducible to the documentary archival record, then you realize that there is something more than just that return gaze, which is just endlessly consolidating, even in a critical way, and refocusing everything on that, you know, the moment of the violent appropriation, the colonial failure, the whatever structure of whiteness. You know, my hope is that one can learn to see and understand these artworks as a demand for something more than that. In the interest of changing things, you know, not the exposure, but the remedy of violence. We're good at exposing violence, I think. I think artists might want to instruct us a little bit about how to change things. I'm sounding like a real old fogey.
We have run out of time now, although it seems like we could have a debate that really is just starting. But I want to thank Siraj Rasool and Rosalind Morris for these very profound, beautiful, and troubling presentations. And I want to invite you to join us in a few minutes in the conference room number 1 on the other side of the ground floor for the Afrosonic Mappings opening talks, among others, with Jihan Altari, Kiluandi Kinda Henda, and Greg Tate. And that's in about, I think we give it like an extra 10-minute delay, so you can have maybe a quick refreshment at the bar on the way there. Thanks for being with us.